Bienvenidos and welcome to the Modern Latino Podcast. Our goal is simple. Have thoughtful conversations about the issues impacting our lives, highlight individuals doing great things in their communities, and finally, celebrate all of the beautiful cultures that make up the Latino diaspora. We do this by keeping an open mind, trying to learn something new, and always treating each other with respect.
Welcome to the Modern Latino with your host Gene and Ivan.
Yes, welcome, familia, bienvenidos.
Sí, bienvenidos.
This is a new podcast. This is called the Modern Latino because we are both Latinos. No, but what we wanted to do was we wanted to create a new podcast that focused on all the issues that were important to us, being Latinos living in a modern world that didn't necessarily maybe align with what people would consider be the things that we should be talking about, right? Like, I feel like a lot of shows are centered around music or food or or things like that. And we wanted to break the mold because
we're a lot more than that.
We're a lot more than that. And and the Latino today, the modern Latino today, they are much more complex and they have different interests and we all have different ideas. And so we didn't really hear any podcasts that were out there that were representing our thoughts.
Exactly. Exactly. We were a lot more than that. You know, we're more than just in politics, than restaurant owners, than millionaires, right?
Yeah, more than salsa singers.
Salsa singers or, you know, athletes. There are many people out there who represent the Latino community that never have their voices heard.
That's right.
And I believe that this podcast, we're going to do that for them.
Exactly. We're going to be looking at our local communities and really we're going to be searching far and wide for people who are leaders or doing unique and special things. So we hope that you'll join us on this journey as we go and we learn more about the people doing special things in our community, but also just trying to make a difference on an everyday level.
And of course, have fun.
We always have fun. And our approach is to be open-minded and to try to learn something new about other people. And to your point, Gene, we're gonna have some fun. Today, though, we're starting our podcast with a very serious subject. We're going to talk about the Palestinian and Israeli war or conflict. I don't know. The words around it are always so sensitive. Crazy. But this situation that is happening right now, we wanted to really have a conversation to make sure that we understand what's happening because it seems like
it's definitely not an easy thing to understand. Not,
you know, but you see everyone responding and reacting.
Yes, and I think that's what it is. I think for us it was important because we see the reactions to something that many people have no idea of why it's happening.
Yeah, they don't understand it.
Exactly. And so in this particular case, we're actually going to have somebody on the show that definitely has an understanding of or the history of what's, you know, why this happened.
Right.
We're not going to be able to solve the problem today on this podcast. I can guarantee you that.
Right. And we're not here like pushing one side or the other. Absolutely. We just want to understand kind of what is happening.
Correct.
So we've got our friend Carlos Acta who's going to join us. He is someone who's got a cool background. We're going to let him kind of do a little bit of his introduction in a couple of minutes. But yeah, hopefully fans listen to the show. Make sure you give yourself some time because this is a complex situation. And I think, you know, we're going to really get down to some nitty gritty.
Absolutely.
And hopefully at the end of it, we're all a little bit smarter about what's going on and we can have better conversations around the dinner table with our friends and with our family. And hopefully as time goes on, the situation resolves itself in a peaceful manner.
Absolutely.
But all right, let's get Carlos on the phone.
All right, 1 second.
This is Carlos.
Carlos, hello. This is Gene and Ivan from the Modern Latino.
Great, here we are.
Yes, sir.
I'm ready to get started.
Welcome. Yeah, we want to say welcome. We want to say thank you for joining us. This is a new podcast, the Modern Latino Podcast. And one of the things that we always try to think about is what's going on in the world and how can we help? And in the case that we want to talk about today, this situation going on between the Palestinian people and the Israeli people is something that is very serious. And so Gene and myself, we were talking about this and we said, if someone asked me what my opinion is, it's really hard for me to make an educated statement because I don't have a lot of background. I don't know a lot about this.
Yeah.
And you see all these people are clearly divided very strongly one way or the other. And, you know, we were saying to ourselves, do these people really even know?
They don't have no idea what
the background
is.
And kind of the history behind this. And so we said, you know, who can we talk to? And so, Carlos, we want to thank you for agreeing to speak to us.
Yes.
We're excited because you've got an interesting background. You've got a background in political science from Columbia University. I think it's political science and international relations, if I'm not mistaken. And
correct.
You worked as a U.S. UN congressional liaison, organizing specialized briefings for members of Congress and UN officials. So you have a lot of perspective, I think, that can be helpful. And then your background is also you're Lebanese and Dominican. So we said this is the perfect person for us to speak to. And so we're excited that you were willing to join us.
Hey, thank you both very much for inviting me on. I really appreciate this opportunity. It's actually quite surprised when I got the invitation, because the context that we're living in right now is, you know, it's pretty gripping, heart-wrenching, confusing. So I really appreciate this, a chance to just, you know, lend you or give you my my thoughts and my ideas. Let me just say again, you know, you spoke a little bit about my background and who I am. Let me tell you who I am not. Number one, I am not a member of any political party, so to speak. I'm not an agent of any country, any movement. Mm-hmm. I am not on the payroll of any government or movement. I mean, I wish I was. I could use money. You know, definitely, but, you know, I'm not. So the outlook that I'm going to give you is my personal outlook. It's off the cuff. I haven't prepared any remarks. It's one that is born, first of all, from a lifetime of being a student of history, mm-hmm. a student of politics. And like you said, you know, I did graduate from Columbia University. I studied under Robert Jervis, who was my faculty advisor and an authority in the field of political science, among others there at the university. You know, I communicated with Professor Edward Said, who was a member of the Palestine National Congress. He was a professor there, professor of comparative literature, actually, at Columbia University, but he's, you know, the most widely read Arab American intellectual. And so I think that I have a decent geopolitical sense, mm-hmm. let's say, one where I spent a good amount of time at the hallways of both the United Nations and the U.S. Congress and the offices of U.N. agencies. You know, I'm giving you, you know, this is my perspective on this.
Yes, of course.
And, you know, I'm glad that you organized this, because one of the things, I think it was Gene who said, you know, it's a very important time and how can we help, right? You know, you have this podcast called The Modern Latino. And I really, really love the whole concept. You know, Gene said, how can we help? Well, the first thing we can do is to get informed.
Yes,
correct, correct.
The second thing we have to do is to raise our voices. Okay. One of the things that really disturbs me, you know, as a Latino, born and raised in New York City, I grew up in the Bronx. I'm the oldest of five. I'm the first person in my family to finish high school, to go to college. You know, and I'm really grateful for the countless blessings that my family has had in this country. But that being said, we, the Latinos in this country, in all of our backgrounds from the 20 plus countries that we are from, we are not monolithic.
Right.
You know, first of all, and the only thing really that we have in common is our origin from, you know, a certain geography and a language, let's say, you mm-hmm. know, Spanish for the most part. And so, you know, there's a lot of differentiation here amongst us. If we go by, you know, origin, whether Mexican, Puerto Rican, Dominican, Colombian, Ecuadorian, Argentine, and then generational.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because, you know, you know, I think you mentioned you were Puerto Rican.
That's right.
Ivan, you know, and so, you know, there's a difference between, let's say, the original pioneers who began arriving here, you know, in significant numbers, I think it was, you know, after World War II,
yes.
Right? And then subsequently, you know, there have been waves of Puerto Rican immigration. And there's differences between, you know, Puerto Ricans from here, from the mainland, and Puerto Ricans from the island, you know, from La Isla. And you know, and you have the same dynamic playing between those of us who were born here, raised here, grew up here, and then the lands, the countries of, you know, of our origins. I think another thing that that Gene mentioned was that, you know, in terms of the topic at hand, which is, let's just say, the situation in the Middle East.
Yes.
And I'm going to be more precise about that.
Yeah.
Let me just tell you this, that even if you have a background, okay, which most people don't, even if you have a background, it is difficult to watch what's going on and not feel a combination of disgust, pain, heartache, and disorientation.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the worst part about that is you're saying that even if you have a background knowledge, even if you don't have any understanding of what's going on, just the actual aspect of the actual situation that's happening before our eyes is out on TV and news 24/7. It is very, very intense. And it's just one of those things that, in a way, you're glad that you're nowhere near there, obviously. But at the same time, there's so many mixed feelings amongst everybody. It's just we're going through a situation right now that is very difficult, like you had said, to explain to anybody, you know, why it is that this is happening. And we're so glad that you're here today because
thank you.
This is the reason why we wanted to do this show, because so many people are misinformed and there's other people that are not informed, that have no knowledge whatsoever, that are just following along, going along with the flow. Yeah. We need to be able to have an understanding and be educated on what's going on, so at least we can have opinions, so at least we can at least think for ourselves and say, hey, I don't think this is right. Maybe we should do this. Maybe we should that. I get what you're saying. I don't feel the same way as you. But you know what? Let's see if we come to some sort of agreement.
Or just like an understanding.
An understanding, absolutely. Yeah. And so once again, thank you once again for being on the show, because we look forward to hearing your thoughts on this entire topic.
And to also to be clear, and we don't have to say this, but we're not going to solve this situation in this conversation. We just want to understand. And the reason why is because there are a lot of people out there with loud voices, and I don't know if they know, you know, the truth behind a lot of the history. I don't know if they know just how far back in us preparing to have this conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about 2 millennia of history, and it's really kind of fascinating to kind of learn about that. And I'm not just talking about like the, you know, the 1900s. I'm talking about, you know, way back. And so this is a complex, dynamic situation here that of course people have deep feelings for. So as Gene said, you know, we're really happy to have you here. And again, we're not looking for you to solve it or tell us who's right or wrong. We just want to just kind of understand what's going on and what your perspective is.
Sure. And it's interesting. You mentioned, you know, because understand something that, dates and time are very important, in this context. And there are a couple of things that I'm going to focus on. One of them is context.
Yes.
Okay. That's a very important word, because the way is that something is framed is the way that we tend to understand it. You just mentioned 2 millennia. Well, it depends on who you ask, because according to the Gregorian calendar, right, that we live under, you know, it's the year 2023, right? We're in the 21st century. According to the Hebrew calendar, it's the year 5784, 5,784 years. And so there are people that are approaching this topic from that angle.
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, going straight to some of the things that Ivan put out there. Let me first begin. Because one of the things we're seeing in the press, and we're talking here about the American press especially, okay, is that the issue is being framed as the Israel-Hamas war. And I think that that is not a coincidence, because the fact is that, yes, on October 7th, a horrific, blood-curdling, awful, unspeakable attack was carried out by Hamas in the adjoining areas right outside the Gaza Strip.
Yes.
And according to the official reports, you know, some 1,400, 1,500 Israeli people lost their lives. The descriptions of what occurred really, it's difficult to wrap your mind around the gruesomeness of the descriptions, and I'm not going to go into them.
Yes, yes.
So let me, you know, be very clear here and say that, you know, I unequivocally, categorically, denounce those acts by Hamas. Okay. Yeah. So for the record, the term, the word Hamas,
yes,
okay, is an acronym,
yes,
in Arabic, and it stands for Al Harakat Al Mukawama Al Islamiya, all right, which means the Islamic Resistance Movement. They are the ones that committed this. But in order to provide context, we have to understand that Hamas did not appear out of nowhere. It's not like somebody, right, you know, opened up a bottle and an evil genie came out. All right. Hamas and Israel have a long history.
Mm-hmm. Hamas was formed in, is, I mean, not recent, but they were formed in the 80s, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. I mean, my understanding of this is that here's the situation. Okay. You know, there's a situation where when you say PLO, mm-hmm, all right,
yes,
Palestine Liberation Organization,
yes, mm-hmm,
that is an umbrella group. It's an umbrella grouping.
Yes.
Okay. It's like you saying United Auto Workers or AFL-CIO, right? There are a lot of subgroups.
Yes.
Under those headings,
yeah,
and so the PLO was the largest, it was the most influential, probably the best financed and the best armed, but there were other groups like, you know, and again, my mentioning of these is not a support for them.
Yes.
I'm just telling you what's out there.
Yeah.
So you had, you know, Fatah, right? Fatah,
yes,
is the organization that was led by Yasser Arafat.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most famous one.
Yes.
But there were other ones like, you know, the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, led by someone named George Habash. There were other groups called, you know, like one called Black September. So there were many different groups, okay, operating against Israel,
mm-hmm,
that were called PLO, but they may not necessarily have been PLO.
Right.
All right. So, but going back to the issue of the media, this is being framed as a war by Israel against Hamas. And yes, it's true. But sources, and, you know, I can look these up for you, point to an uncomfortable history of Israel with Hamas, because Hamas, you know, Hamas basically begins in the occupied, you know, territories, okay, of Gaza and the West Bank or the Transjordan, and they were unwilling and uncompromising to deal with Israel in ways that, let's just say, Fatah, which is a secular movement, has been, right? So, you know, for instance, you know, Hamas was originally implemented by the Israeli government to act as a foil,
mm-hmm,
okay? And there has been a lot of internal bloody violence between followers of Hamas and those of Fatah, okay? So, you know, in 2000, I believe it was in 2006, Hamas had been a political movement. They had, you know, been in control of certain areas, of certain villages. There were elections there. Mm-hmm. Between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, right, led by Yasser Arafat. Mm-hmm. The outcome of that election, which was an internationally observed election, one that was considered a fair election, was that Hamas won, especially in Gaza. Yeah. The problem is that Israel did not want to deal with Hamas because, according to them, Hamas has set in its charter the outright destruction right. of Israel. Mm-hmm. And so the United States and the European Union followed the tack of Israel and imposed sanctions. And basically, Israel decided to lock Hamas, lock the people of Gaza up there, throw away the key, and let them, let's just say, degenerate. Okay, so we're talking now about 2006 to now. I mean, we're over 20 years, I think, mm-hmm. yeah. Close to 20 years now, where over 2 million people cannot go in or out. Israel has control over their airspace, over who comes in, who comes out, their water, their sea, and, you know, just routinely imposes closures. Now, you know, the Israelis will argue, and I think it's a fair argument, by the way, that, hey, you know, in 2005, you know, against all the opposition in the world, Ariel Sharon, who was the prime minister at the time, mm-hmm. He basically said, we're going to get out of Gaza.
Yes.
And there were, you know, a number of settlements there.
21 settlements, I believe.
Yes. Yes. I don't know the exact number, but, you know, one of them was called Gush Katif. And you know, the Israelis, several thousand were pulled out of there. And okay, it was very controversial. There were serious riots. There were serious confrontations between the Israelis and the Israeli army. But ultimately, they pulled everybody out. And okay, so Gaza's in there. You know, Hamas is in there. They're locked in there. And what are they going to do? Well, you know, it's very complicated because, in my opinion, you know, you don't make peace with your friends. You make peace with your enemies. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was a mistake to turn this 25, I think it's about 25 miles by mm-hmm. about maybe three miles, yeah. this strip of land into a huge open air prison.
Okay.
Okay. And so, you know, I ask the audience that, you know, what would you do if I locked you in a closet? And all you had at your disposal was maybe a pocket knife. Mm-hmm. You know, human ingenuity and the will to survive and fight is incredible. And Hamas, you know, and these people, they have allies all over the world. We can just use Jewish history to look at what occurred during the Second World War and the Warsaw Uprising. Where the Jews were, you know, outgunned, outmanned, and yet they put up an incredibly heroic resistance against the Nazis, killed tons of Nazis, armed with, you know, with just, you know, some weapons. But you're talking about people who were starving, people who were dying, people who essentially had nothing left to lose
yeah.
but their dignity. And the same can be applied to the people of Gaza. They're not going to give up.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's so, you know, you can't just call this the Israeli Hamas war. This latest conflict arises in the context of 75 years right. of yeah. conflict.
Yeah. And that's a really interesting point. And one that I think many people do not fully understand, because When I started thinking about this and started looking into it, I didn't realize that Palestine, right, like I guess that land was part of the Ottoman territories that were placed under the administration of the UK by the League of Nations back in 1922. Correct. That I didn't know. And it's interesting because if you ask most people, I don't think that they would know that. I think most people just remember or they gravitate towards the 1947 decision of
sure.
the UN to divide that, you know, I guess it was a British mandate of Palestine into two states, which was one was Jewish and one was Arab.
Correct.
With Jerusalem being under international control or administration because of its importance to Judaism, Christianity, mm-hmm. and Islam. So I didn't realize that it went back as far. And this is the point that I was making about the history, the ancient history of that land in terms of how many people have like gone after it and invaded yeah. it and conquered it.
But let's hold this for a second, just so that everybody can get yeah. an understanding. And so you're describing the small land of Gaza, or you talk about Israel in itself?
Because I'm talking about that whole Palestinian area.
Correct. So, but that's what I'm saying. So, like
encompassing Gaza, encompassing the West Bank.
Mm-hmm. So technically, Israel, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the land, that particular land in
yes.
itself. That's what.
But let me
about.
Just add, Ivan, yes. That yes, I mean the British. The UK received a mandate by the League of Nations to govern what was called at the time Palestine.
Yes.
And that Palestine mm-hmm. Included not only what is today, let's say, Israel
yeah.
And the occupied territories, but the entire territory of Jordan.
Yes.
All right.
Okay. So it's not just Israel, but it's also Jordan. All right. And, it's very important to understand that at the time, obviously, you know, one of the things that you've got to take into consideration is that the reason that those territories came under European control is because of the Arab Legion.
Yeah.
And this brings us to a gentleman by the name of T.E. Lawrence. Of Lawrence of Arabia fame, mm-hmm. who organized the Arabs of the Hejaz. The Hejaz is those of Iraq, the Arabian Peninsula, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Palestine, to battle against the Turks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it was, you know, under T.E. Lawrence's leadership that they defeated the Turks. There and it was a critical theater of the war because obviously the British had in their agenda, you know, accessing number one the oil resources of the area, and number two, protection of their access to the Suez Canal mm-hmm. and their control over it. Okay, so you've always got to look beyond what's going on, mm-hmm. right? It's not just the immediate, but it's what is happening in the long term. What is the long term outcome? Now, I don't know if you both saw, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, which is a magnificent film, but you know, one of the things that occurs in it is that T.E. Lawrence wanted to give the Arabs their freedom, their independence, mm-hmm. whereas the British and the French had other plans. So the British got the mandate over Palestine. The French got a mandate over what became Lebanon and Syria. Mm-hmm. All right. And so that British duplicity played out in a document that was called the Balfour Declaration.
Right.
Mr. Balfour essentially issued a document that you know, was dated actually
1917,
November 2nd, 1917.
Yeah.
So keep in mind yeah. that we're talking now some 108 years ago in a week.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Wow.
You know, very interesting there, and so this was a very, very vague document. All right. Nonetheless, it opened the way to massive Jewish immigration from Europe. And we have here, let's just say, this is called the telegram that got a ball rolling to where we are today. So that leads to one of the main points here that, you know, you pointed out to me, Ivan. You know, what are the issues that are important to the side? What are the issues, for instance, that are important to the Israelis? Well, you know, we have to understand that for over 2,000 years, following the expulsion of the Jews from Roman Palestine, okay, the area was renamed Syria Palestina by one of the Roman emperors. I believe it was Augustus. I could be wrong. So in 79 AD, there's a, you know, there's a revolt, and fundamentally the Jews from this area are killed en masse. They're expelled, they're enslaved, and thus the diaspora of the Jewish people begins, and they spread all over the world. During this time, everywhere they go, and we're talking about, you know, every country in the Mediterranean, on both sides of the Mediterranean, from let's just say from Portugal to Russia, and from Morocco to Iraq. Okay, there are Jewish communities. Now, in the European context, there is a history of what I call Judeophobia, as opposed to anti-Semitism, because I think that that is a term that is misused. Semites are people, a variety of people who speak the Semitic languages. These are, you know, Arabic, Hebrew, Amharic, Chaldean, Assyrian, okay? Those are all Semitic languages. So all the people, arguably, from Morocco to Iraq are Semites.
Yeah.
The Jews are not the only Semites. But, you know, using it within the context of European Jewish hatred, I will use anti-Semitism in that context. And it was bloody. It was horrific. It was inhumane. Countless histories of dispossession and death and discrimination that culminated ultimately in the Second World War. So the Jews under the leadership of the Zionist movement that had been founded by an Austrian Jew named Theodor Herzl decide that they're going to return to their biblical homeland, to have a state of their own where they can be the masters of their own destiny. And the tagline for this, that we're going to go to a, we are people that are going to go to a land that has no people, right? Except that there were
people,
many people there. And they had been there for centuries. And those people, the Palestinian Arabs in the majority, although there were some Jews, you know, they're descendants in many cases of the different waves of conquerors and peoples that entered that area throughout, you know, the history of the Mediterranean. We're talking about Greeks, we're talking about Arabs, we're talking about Assyrians, we're talking about Romans, we're talking about Turks. You know, the list is endless of different peoples that have conquered and lived in that area and made it their own.
Yeah.
And Carlos, I thought it was interesting because to that last point, and number one, you are a fountain of knowledge. So thank you for sharing everything that you're sharing.
I appreciate that.
One of the things that I thought was interesting to your point about that tagline is that before the Balfour Declaration and kind of like this decision for the Jewish people to kind of, I guess, migrate to this land, they, to your point, there were Jewish people living side by side with Arab people in relative peace, right? Like they were, that was not an unusual situation at the time.
There were people, I mean, you know, there were always, there was a remnant of Jewish people who were there, who were descendants of the original Jewish people who were there, and then there were others who made their way throughout the centuries, but you know, they were living in peace.
Yes.
with the local Arab people, and they, you know, they survived like their neighbors under the occupation of different governments. The final one being that of the British administration in the wake of World War One.
So then after the Balfour Declaration, and I forgot the name of the person that you said who was kind of spearheading or kind of
the Theodore Herzl.
Theodore Herzl. It was when the Nazi persecution really started happening in the 30s that really kind of made those numbers increase in terms of the migration to that land. Is it not? And is that part of what started some of this?
Actually, I mean, as soon as the Balfour Declaration became this working passport, so to speak, for the Zionist movement, you know, a lot of people started heading there. Theodor Herzl and other Jewish thinkers were warning the Jews that something very dark and very catastrophic laid in the horizon if the Jews did not leave. So problems really start beginning, after the Balfour Declaration, because a lot of the people arriving there, they arrived not as people that wanted to live in peace and respect with the local Arab people, but rather as, let's just say, colonizers, right? Yeah. Where, you know, this land is ours and you're the outsiders. All right. And, you know, you have to look into the philosophy of Zionism to understand the roots of a lot of the anger and confrontation. Number one, you know, the Zionists wanted to reclaim the land. And that was a physical, you know, reclamation. Okay. There was a group of people that were called the Chalutzim. Mm-hmm. And the Chalutzim were like farmers, right? And these people were gonna work that land and make it come to life. And they would only hire Jews in many cases.
Yeah.
Okay. Because they wanted it to be a Jewish project, right? Another thing that the Zionists wanted more than anything else, is that they wanted their own state.
Yes.
They didn't want to have a state where they were going to be a minority. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And given their history, it's understandable that they would want that.
Yeah.
All right. But problems started arising. And in 1929, there was a famous, pogrom, let's just call it what it's called, you know, that resulted in the murder, I think, of some 30 Jewish people. But there had been, you know, attacks back and forth between the Zionists and the local Arabs, such that now, in World War II happens, and there was a person by the name of, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was the Mufti of Jerusalem, and he was the highest ranking Islamic figure, in Jerusalem. Of a very old Palestinian family who did not want more Jewish immigration to Palestine. In my opinion, it was an issue of political expediency, clearly. He went to Hitler and said, look, we don't want these people here. You do whatever you're going to do with them.
Yeah.
But they're coming here, they're taking over, and we don't want them here. And that really is the extent to which, Haj Amin had any role in this. I mean, you know, the Nazi plan to exterminate the Jewish people in Europe did not come about because of anything that Haj Amin or the Palestinians did. I always make a point of telling people that in the death camps of Europe, there were Ukrainian guards, there were Germans, there were Hungarians, there were Romanians, there were Lithuanians, there were Estonians, there were Latvians, there were SS units from many occupied European countries. But one thing that I can tell you is that there were no Palestinians overseeing the murder and the destruction of the Jewish people in Europe.
Yeah.
Okay. But again, problems begin you know, as a result of you know, the massive immigration that was coming in the 20s. And the Jews really, you know, in some respects had no choice but to head to what was still being called Palestine.
Right.
It's referred to as Palestine in all of the official documents of the period. And then, well, you know, in I think it was in November of 1947, finally there, I believe that the Israel-Palestinian conflict is the first real international conflict that the UN dealt with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a vote and they decided to partition the land. Between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River into two states.
Yes.
Now, the Jews accepted the partition. The Arabs did not. And you can say, okay, well, I mean, you know, the Jews were willing to share the land and the Arabs weren't, and they deserve everything that came afterwards. Well, okay, that's one point of view. But understand that, you know, they were going to, you know, this partition was not going to simply be a simple exercise of drawing a line here and drawing a line there and everything is going to be kumbaya.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about uprooting. We're talking about conflict. We're talking about people being pushed out, people being murdered. The Arabs, the Palestinians felt that they were cheated. They were not consulted in this. And, it, you know, culminated in the first war, which the Israelis won. And since then, you know, we've seen since 1948, you know, a series of conflicts. You know, we had the next one in 1967 where the Israelis finally conquered, you know, what was under Jordanian control at the time, the Transjordan or the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
And that's the Six-Day War that you're referencing.
The Six-Day War of 1967, correct. And all of a sudden now, you know, they control everything.
Excuse me, Carlos. I'm sorry. Yeah. Really, really quick. So the land, you're talking about the two states, right? Now,
yes.
So the land or the separation that you're discussing, again, just so for, to be well informed here, you're talking about it, what is Israel today and what is part of Jordan. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. So what is Israel today? And there are many maps, right? And then you have, according to international law, the armistice lines, after the 1967 that, you know, consider the West Bank and the Gaza Strip to be occupied Palestinian land, right?
Got it.
And that building and settling on that land is a contravention of international law. Right. However, in the wake of this situation, beginning with the labor government back in the 60s, in the late 60s, they began settling, you know, the Transjordan or what they call Judea and Samaria, to be the biblical heartland, right?
Carlos, I don't mean to interrupt. There's just one fact that I want to make sure that I'm clear on, because it's a question that I specifically have for you. In 1947, November, the UN voted to create the two states, the Jewish state and the Arab state.
Correct.
But in 1948, Israel declared independence, and that was followed by conflicts and wars. And there was one specific event that I know is particularly significant. It's called the Nakba. The question that I have is, what does that mean that Israel declared independence?
Okay, and that's a great question. To me, it's a troublesome term, and the reason
I know it is, I know it is,
it's crazy
because it's not like the Jews of Israel were under the control of the Turks or the British or the Arabs, right? In Hebrew, it's called Yom Ha'atzma'ut, okay? And it literally means, you know, the Independence Day. And it's you know, again, you have to understand something, that a lot of the language that is used here is also marketing. It's also political. Okay. You know, they are reaching out with this language to an international audience that is meant to be sympathetic to them. Okay. So the idea is that just like the United States that had its Independence Day, you know, July 4th from the British, the Jews also had their Independence Day from the Arabs, right? Mm-hmm. However, you know, for the Arabs, well, you know, they weren't controlling them. They were trying to retain control over their own lives. And the subsequent establishment of the State of Israel, you know, became this event that is recognized in the Arab world as the Nakba. You know, the Nakba is the catastrophe.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the interesting things is that there's a whole series of Jewish Israeli thinkers and writers who have said the mythology about Israel is a falsehood. The mythology about Israel is a twisting of fact. Okay. And there's a list of them. And so, you know, I I've been called, you know, an anti-Semite because of my objections to many of the exactions and abuses and humiliations and violation of international law carried out by Israel against the Palestinians. But there are people like Avi Schleim, Ilan Pape, Miko Peled, and the list is countless of Israeli academics who have said the story, the mythology that we have been fed and that Israel has fed to the world is a falsehood. We came in here as, you know, Moshe Dayan once put it, you must remember the famous Israeli general, Moshe Dayan, who said, you know, we're coming in as settlers. And in order for us to plant a tree, you know, we're going to have to basically push these people out of their land, a land that they've lived in for centuries. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this whole series of different thinkers who say, you know, that the occupation, and let's just understand what the occupation means, because a lot of people don't understand that.
Yeah.
You know, and it may sound silly and dumb what I'm going to say, but, you know, to the average person out there, they hear occupation. Well, what is that? A job? What is that?
Yeah.
The occupation is the domination of the Palestinians by the Israelis. The control over their political lives, their economic lives, where they can live, where they can work, where they can go. That is the occupation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now let's be very clear about something, because there are over a million people in Israel, Arabs, Palestinians, who are descendants of the original Palestinians who were there when the state was formed, and they were given citizenship, and they're referred to not as Palestinians, but as Israeli Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But, you know, the point is that, again, a lot of this is marketing. A lot of this is political wordsmanship. Okay. So going back to the term, Jewish Independence Day, Israeli Independence Day. Oh, well, you know, in the minds of a lot of people, you know, they were battling the Arabs the same way that George Washington and the colonials here were battling against the British,
right,
and,
right, yeah,
you know, crossing the Delaware and all this stuff that, you know, is powerful, because look, mythology is powerful. Okay. Mythology reaches deep into our psyches. And all of us, without exception, we are impacted by mythologies about who we are. Mythologies help to explain the world to us and why things are the way they are or they're not.
Yeah.
Right. No, and you're 100% true, 100% correct in how you describe that with respect to our own, you know, fight for independence and kind of like the history and the mythology. In fact, you mentioned this, and I didn't really know that this was something that we would get to, but like when you mentioned like dates and like today, I as a result of researching this, Today is the 85th anniversary of what the Jews call Kristallnacht.
Correct.
Which was the program by, the Nazis, where they smashed the stores and buildings and synagogues and ultimately destroyed 7,000 businesses and arrested 30,000 Jewish men. I mean, it's just, to your point about words and mythology, like, all of this stuff is so powerful. And I could see why people, of course, are so personally invested. I don't know if that's the right word, but just kind of like it pulls on them.
Yeah. But it's also,
well, yeah, absolutely. And it's not just, let's say, Jews and Palestinians who face each other in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. It's the entirety of Western civilization. It's the entirety of, you know, let's say, Eastern Islamic civilization. Mm-hmm. The history, the conflict, the bloodletting, it's incredibly powerful. And you've got to understand that the Jewish story in the West is inextricably stitched in. The Jewish story, the Bible, okay, the Jewish patriarchs, that is stitched in into our identity as, you know, as let's say, you know, we refer often to the Judeo-Christian heritage. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, you know, a lot of people choose to view this conflict ultimately as good versus evil. And everything that is happening in the Middle East is because God designed it that way. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very powerful. You know, speaking about Kristallnacht, I'll give you an example of something that happened to me. I go to Germany regularly, mm-hmm. and I was in a town where, there was a plaque, on the ground commemorating the site where there was a synagogue that was destroyed on Kristallnacht. Mm-hmm. And I've got to let you in on something. I was there and I had to get a grip of myself. Mm. I had to stop for a moment and almost slap myself. I was heading to some business meetings. I was so shocked, let's just say emotionally, that I was standing in the country where this occurred in a location where this took place. Uh-huh. Right. And, you know, I, again, you know, I'm this guy from the Bronx. Right. You know, born after all this horror happened. And yet I feel gripped by this story. So we're talking about something that's very powerful.
Indeed.
Absolutely. Indeed. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and if you fast forward 50, 60 years from now, and we hope that at some point this comes to an end, what's going on there. But I can see how our younger generation can travel to Israel, to the Gaza area, and reflect just like you did in Germany in regards to all the stuff that's going on today. So it's kind of like, you know, comes full circle. And in a way, history, we talk about this, repeats itself. And we hope that it comes to an end at some point. And, you know, we do reflect and hope to understand what exactly is going on. Now, you gave us such great definitions and explanation into everything that's going on. My fear, and talking to Ivan, is that, you know, aside from people such as ourselves that want to understand, that want to seek the truth, we know we're living in a situation where, or an environment now where people really don't want to look for that. They just want to maybe follow the easiest path. And so with everything that's going on, I'm hoping that whoever's listening to us, that they really reflect on everything that you're saying, and that you're trying to bring it down or to explain it in a way where people can really say, hey, you know what? we're going to have to talk this thing out. we're going to have to figure something out, because the way you explained it, there's just no easy solution.
You could see the personal, like I said, the personal investment that every side has.
Yeah.
And to your point about it, on both sides, people will think it's good versus evil. And
correct.
Whoever is good is depending on, you know, who you're asking.
Sure.
But Carlos, let me ask you to Gene's point, to kind of fast forward. I know back in 1993, the PLO and Israel committed to a peace plan, and they had a path for Palestinian self-rule. I guess that was part of the first Oslo Accords. I'm not an expert on that.
Correct.
But why hasn't peace, and I kind of know a little bit of the background with Hamas and PLO, but why hasn't it been able to work? What do you think?
That's a very good question.
I know it's like the million-dollar question, but I mean,
you know, let's go back to Oslo, right?
Yeah.
We have a meeting there presided by Bill Clinton, and you've got Yasser Arafat on one side, and you've got Yitzhak Rabin, among others, representing the Israeli side in the great lawn of the White House. And the Oslo Accords were the result of diplomatic maneuvering and work by the Norwegian government, trying to see ways that they could bring the sides closer to see how we can advance peace and a different outcome to what had been going on. Now, ultimately, the Oslo Accords essentially established, one, the recognition by the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, of the right of Israel to exist. Number two, that the PLO would renounce, quote-unquote, terrorism, okay, against the Israelis. On the other side, the Israeli government would recognize the Palestinian Authority as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. All right. And the Palestinian Authority was to be given control over certain areas of the West Bank and Gaza, amongst other things. But the problem with the Oslo Accords, especially in the words of Edward Said, is that they were critical aspects of the problem that were left on the back burner, and they didn't stop burning. Okay, number one. First off, the issue of Jerusalem. Okay.
Yes.
Which, you know, as you mentioned earlier, it's a holy city to the Jews, to the Christians, and it is the third holiest city in Islam. Mm-hmm. Okay. Has a huge significance there. And then there's the issue of the return of refugees. All right. I mean, there are some, I don't know, I think almost 5 million Palestinian refugees spread throughout the world and living in refugee camps in many, you know, Middle Eastern countries. Mm-hmm. You know, that was not, you know, taken into account. But the fact is that, under Rabin's leadership, the Israelis were ready to give up land for peace. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What happened? Well, two years later, someone by the name of Yigal Amir, a radical Jewish law student, considered Yitzhak Rabin to be a traitor. And we're talking about somebody, you know, a Jewish hero who had buckets of Palestinian blood in his hand, but he was ready to make concessions for peace. He was assassinated in November of 95, I believe.
Yes.
Following that, you know, there was a series of governments that came in that didn't stop the settlement building. Okay. So all this time, they're discussing peace, but at the same time, they are undoing the possibility of having a Palestinian state that has any kind of territorial contiguity. Okay. And so the Palestinians are seeing this and saying, well, you know, we're supposed to be sharing this pizza, but you know, you know, I'm supposed to get the crust, and while we're talking, you're eating the crust.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, you know, Yigal Amir is, in my opinion, a critical figure because he assassinated Rabin. I think he did this with the connivance, and this is my opinion, okay, of people who are in power today. I think that Netanyahu is, if not obviously materially responsible, but he's politically responsible. He's morally responsible. He and these radical Zionist groups that operate within the Israeli body politic, who basically they're dedicated to a non, you know, like the idea of a two states for them is a non-starter.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So, Netanyahu has repeatedly made, statements to that effect. So, that's one of the reasons that, you know, to this very day, even now, we are receiving daily, weekly, monthly reports of settler violence against Palestinians who've been living in certain lands. They're bulldozing their homes. They're kicking them out. They're killing them. Because these people have, and this is the interesting thing, these people, that are pushing this, they have, a mindset of biblical eschatology.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? These people believe that they are in an end time conflict. Mm-hmm. All right. These are people that want to they want to destroy Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Right.
Because they want to build the third temple. They believe that with the building of the third temple, the Messiah will finally come.
Yeah.
And they intend, you know, there are plans. I mean, you can look this up. All right. So on the one hand, you have this group of radical Zionists who believe that the land should be, you know, just purified of what, you know, Netanyahu recently called Amalek. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. And then, but on the other side, you have Hamas,
right,
which has a similar point of view. Okay. They also believe that they are in an end time conflict with the infidels, with the Jews. And they don't want to, you know, for them, killing and dying is just a means to an end.
Yeah. Is Hamas the group behind the, I've read about the intifadas. Is that something that Hamas?
It's interesting. Intifada again, you know, I think you know what intifada means. Basically, intifada, you know, comes from, you know, shaking off. Okay. Mm-hmm. The Intifada, events began, you know, the first and second Intifada, mm-hmm. Hamas was not really part of that yet. Okay. They were not directing that. But it was these Palestinian uprisings, mm-hmm, that led to, you know, the Oslo Accords, that led to that subtle diplomacy.
Yeah.
All right. But I do not believe, at least I don't know, that Hamas was directing that. I mean, you can be sure that there were some elements of them there. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were horrific acts of violence committed against Israeli. We're talking about bombs going off in cafes, bombs going off on buses, mm-hmm, you know, just absolutely horrible things. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, the Intifadas, essentially basically pushed the Israelis to finally say, okay, we're going to have to make a deal. Now, people forget that there was a Palestinian National Committee that was in the West Bank before the Palestinian Authority. It was led by a man by the name of Faisal Husseini, who comes from, again, a very old Palestinian family, a woman named Hanan Ashrawi, who is still alive today, and a gentleman by the name of Haider Abdel Shafi. The interesting thing about this group is that they were ready to accept a smaller, reduced Palestinian state and not deal with the Palestinian diaspora. Mm-hmm. Okay. However, again, the Israelis, and when I'm referring to Israelis, I'm referring especially, not exclusively, to Netanyahu, they decided, no, you know, we're going to continue this playing game. We're going to continue this waiting game, and we can't make a deal with you. We're going to pull Arafat, who was in Tunis, in Tunisia at the time.
Yeah.
And they brought him back. Okay. And they began this process that we see today. It's gone back and forth mm-hmm. and gone nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, what I have been saying over and over again is that, what occurred on October 7th should not be a surprise to anyone. Okay. I'm actually amazed it didn't occur sooner. And speaking to one of the points that you gave me, Ivan, you know, the public response, right, in the U.S. and the world. Well, you know, what we've been seeing is pro-Palestinian marches in every major capital. Okay. We're talking Madrid, we're talking Paris, we're talking Rome, we're talking Amsterdam, we're talking Brussels, we're talking London, we're talking Sydney, okay? We're talking everywhere in the world that there is a significant Palestinian presence. By the way, a presence that is the result of the expulsions.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, number one, there are people who are out there saying this cannot continue. So that while the media wants to make this about Hamas, this is about much more than Hamas.
Yeah.
Okay. And you know, it's very unfortunate that you know, our political class here doesn't have the bravery to really bring both sides and say, we're going to have two states because this cannot continue.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Carlos, let me ask you a quick question. So in some of the, and again, it's just, this is me reading and just watching TV and, you know, sure, discussing this with other fellow friends. Which is kind of interesting too, because I never really thought of it this way or really believe that. But one of the thought processes out there is that Israel, in essence, had or they put so much pressure into the whole situation there that they ultimately wanted something like this to happen for them to now retaliate completely and take over, or maybe not take over the land, but completely get rid of Hamas, obviously with the underground tunnels there, with everything there. I don't particularly believe that. What would you think? Like, do you think that Israel kind of like
purposely
put them, yeah, more,
I don't know,
or kind of like checkmated them where they said, oh, you know,
I don't know about that.
I know. And again, because these are all little topics that you hear out there, oh, yeah, today. Yeah. And that's, sure, and that's the reason why we're doing this, is because, sure, there's so much out there that people are confused, and people just, and again, they're just out there doing their thing because they feel that this is the way it is, and right, and right, this and that. But we need to be able to at least discount,
yeah,
some,
yeah,
of this stuff so that this way they don't feel that way. So
it's very difficult to understand something, mm-hmm, to unpack all of this and flesh it out,
yeah,
and organize it and understand it, number one. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, there's a lot of talk, a lot about rumors out there about Israeli intentions. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let me just say this. Ultimately, what has been going on for a long time is that the Palestinians who want peace and the Israelis who want peace are caught between a Palestinian anvil and an Israeli hammer. Mm-hmm. There is ultimately a very perverse logic to what's occurring. Netanyahu and Hamas are both faces of the same coin, in my opinion.
Okay.
Okay. And ultimately, you know, there are innocents that are whose lives are, you know, what's interesting is that both sides commit their acts, and then show the world, look, the other side killed all of our babies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mind you, they're both using the same playbook. You killed our babies, you're evil. You killed our babies, you're evil. Okay? So there's this perverse logic where actually Hamas and Netanyahu, and by the way, the Netanyahu government, it's interesting because you know that in recent months there have been a lot of protests and a lot of political instability. Yeah. Because of the cabinet formed by Netanyahu. I mean, right. The interior minister is a guy named Bezalel Smotrich, mm-hmm. who is a radical Zionist who basically appears in public with maps showing all of historic Palestine. Right. That includes Jordan and, you know, Israel in many of his briefings and his discussions. Okay. Right. So that's the interior minister. And then you have the security minister is a guy named Itamar Gavir. Gavir is a guy who was, you know, basically prosecuted for terrorism.
Wow.
Okay. So these are the guys that are driving Israeli policy. And there's a whole there's a whole series of members of the Knesset that are radical Zionists. Okay. That the only difference between them and Hamas is their religion. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, they have no problem with destroying and ethnically cleansing Israel and Gaza, the Palestinians. And likewise, Hamas has no problem killing as many Israelis as they can.
Yeah.
You know, I find it so disappointing because, number one, with all of this warfare, we're talking about lands that are historic and ancient, that have history and beauty, and they just, you know, they're just the victim of warfare. You know, on both sides.
The land of milk and honey.
Yes,
the
exactly.
Promised land.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that's really disappointing. The other thing that, and again, I'm no expert, but the other thing that kind of, that really puzzles me is when these kinds of events happen, now you have the international community coming in and giving resources and support and money and whatever. Well, why weren't they doing that? If this was something that they really wanted to do, why weren't they doing that like 2 months ago? Why does it take an event like this to kind of, you know, get that going? And it just seems counter.
I absolutely agree with you. I mean, my question is, Hamas has been in power there in Gaza for close to 20 years or something like that. Why has there not been an international, you know, conference on Gaza to force Hamas to come to the table, mm-hmm. and have them play ball?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Because understand something. Hamas is, let's say, dedicated to the destruction of Israel, right? So they're a terrorist organization. Well, guess what? The ANC, the African National Congress, was once considered a terrorist organization.
Mm-hmm.
Sinn Féin.
Yes.
And the Irish Republican Army were considered a terrorist movement.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. In Southwest Africa, Namibia, SWAPO, the Southwest African People's Organization, was considered a terrorist organization, and they became a political party. All right. Oh, but wait a minute. Let's not even go any further. There are posters out there from British Mandate Times seeking the arrest for terrorism of people like Menachem Begin. Okay, mm-hmm. For terrorism, you know, these guys who were in the Stern Gang and Lehi, you know. So in other words, if you want to move forward, you have to end the isolation, bring these people to the table, and mm-hmm. demand that they behave responsibly.
Yes,
but that was not done.
Yeah.
And that country, that area, was just degrading there for over 20 years. And what we've been seeing there, in my opinion, is just unbelievable. As one friend of mine would put it, what has occurred there is simply unlanguageable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. Well, I was just going to, I mean, this has been, like, again, very illuminating for me and very helpful to kind of understand it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's so many layers, and that we can continue to peel different ways.
Absolutely.
You but what, and we've, you know, we're almost at the end of our show in the sense that I feel like we're taking up all of your time and we could talk about this for hours. But
absolutely.
But what I wanted to kind of mention to you is you attended Columbia University, one of the best, you know, considered one of the Ivy League best schools in the world. And there is a lot of discussion around the level of activity and protests happening specifically at the Ivy League
absolutely.
Level.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And there's a lot of backlash.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's your thought about that?
Look, you know,
and also specifically about the backlash. Companies looking at the people protesting, things like that.
You know, it's a really bizarre time for me. I mean, you know, growing up as an American, believing in all of the foundation of political freedoms that we have here, amongst them the right of free speech guaranteed by the First Amendment, our right to rally, our right to organize and demand, you know, redress. These are fundamental elements of American political life. And, you know, right now there are people out there who want to quash anything on campuses that is remotely Palestinian, pro-Palestinian. And, you know, I'm not going to tell you that there haven't been some events. Recently, there was a situation over at Cooper Union. Yeah. Where, you know, a group of Palestinian students or their supporters were menacing, you know, Jewish students who were in a library. That is unacceptable and despicable. Okay. But the idea that, you know, every single manifestation for the defense of Palestinian rights and Palestinian and it's all over the newspapers. I mean, we're talking Harvard, we're talking Columbia, we're talking Penn, we're talking Brown. Where students have come out and said what is happening to the Palestinians is simply unacceptable. And donors, okay, have been, you know, threatening and pulling millions of dollars of their support from these institutions. And these institutions have in turn been, you know, trying to ban and stop and outlaw. Columbia specifically has had like doxing trucks, okay, mm-hmm. where a student out there who has been very vocal against the situation by the Israelis, they have their face, you know, and their names. And, you know, this is, you know, Columbia's most famous anti-Semite, right?
Yeah.
You know, there are cases of people likewise who have been ripping down the posters of people who were kidnapped by Hamas.
Yeah.
You know, children, babies, you know, and there's been a lot of unacceptable behavior, okay?
And I have to say, I don't understand that part of it, because you can protest, you can have your position, you can have conversations, you can say whatever you want. I don't understand, and that's why I think a conversation like what we're having is important. Because there are people who are maybe not taking those actions, but they don't know. Yeah, and they still don't, and they don't have the information that I know these people must not have.
But the other thing from, again, my understanding and with everything that's going on too, I think it's more from what I hear and from what I read is the fact that many of these protesters do not acknowledge what happened October 7th. Like they don't, like they're not, they're justified with that whole act in itself, and so now they're just raising awareness to the Palestinians, but disregarding the October 7th incident. And so I think that's part of what's igniting all this stuff, like the anti-Semitism and all. Cause, you know, because they're saying that they had it coming, or that it's, you know, 1,400 people were lost, but look how many more thousands are being, you know, killed by the Israelis. Well,
yeah, but again, you know, it's sorry to cut you off, but yeah. Again, it's the, you know, I kill your babies,
yeah,
and you kill my babies. Oh, you're bad, you're evil. You're bad, you're evil.
Correct.
Right? It's this, you know, victim game where, again, both sides are committing atrocities. Except that, you know, the Palestinians, for every Jew that the Palestinians are killing,
yeah,
you know, the Jews are killing 100 Palestinians or 1,000 or whatever, right? And where is this going to go, where do people think this can go? You know, I don't think it's helpful for the government and for universities and for institutions to try to abolish people's rights to organize and rally mm-hmm. and protest. On the other hand, I don't care what side you're on. You cannot menace people. You cannot intimidate people. You cannot attack people. Okay. That is also unacceptable.
Yeah. Yeah. No, listen, it's a very difficult situation. And for me, the way we discuss it over here.
Yeah.
It's one of those situations where, yeah, let's sit down, let's discuss it, and let's try to understand. But it's not that easy. I mean, it's just there are so many thought processes out there that
absolutely
that is just almost impossible to really. As you see, was very difficult for us in a period of an hour to try to quell this thing in some particular way, and it's just there's just no way of doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, no matter what you say. You could come back on the opposite side and say, well, there's this and that. And then, well, there's this and that. And back and forth. And it just seems like almost like a lost cause. It really does, man. I mean.
Well, the thing is that the lost cause, what is the lost cause going to be if this escalates any further?
Right.
If Iran gets involved.
Exactly.
Okay. If the Israelis use any type of weapons of mass destruction against Iran. It will raise the level of violence and destruction that this threatens. And by the way, understand something. Any kind of volatility mm-hmm. in the Persian Gulf is going to destabilize the global economy.
Of course. Okay, so, of course.
So we're talking about the shutting down of global supply chains, which you just saw what happened with COVID.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, and that'll be a cakewalk compared to what happens if Iran blows up ships in the Persian Gulf and blocks the Strait of Hormuz. Okay, and not to mention that, you know, there could be just elevated levels of violence all over the world over this. So, my position on this is that members of the Security Council are going to have to bring. Yeah, pressure to bear on the Israelis, especially, but not exclusively, and the international community to create some kind of consensus. Because even Joe Biden himself said, we cannot go back to the status quo ante.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're going to have to go back to serious discussions of the two-state solution. And now, and here's the irony, right? So originally the Zionists were against, were for a two-state solution, supposedly, and against a one-state solution. The Arab side was against a two-state solution. What they wanted was a binational state. Well, there is now a binational state. We're back to square one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Except that one group of people have political rights and the other doesn't.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's unsustainable. Transfer this situation, this scenario to any other country, and that regime came down. Okay?
Yeah.
And so the United States and NATO are going to need to make the kind of commitment to peace and state building that they have made in Europe after the Second World War. You know, the same commitment that was made to rebuild Germany, to rebuild Japan.
Right.
Okay. They're going to, in my opinion, it's going to have to be some type of military and political, operation to separate the sides. A lot of people are going to be angry. But what is the alternative?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at everything that's going on, too, and you're talking about the United States, with Iran or their proxy units.
Hezbollah
and Lebanon, right?
Yeah.
Attacking attacking military bases or installations and U.S. personnel getting hurt. I mean, that's pretty much already for me. And I was a former military. I'm a former Marine.
Wow.
That's more than enough. Like for me, that's more than enough to say, hey, guess what? They already attacked, 20-something times or 40-something times? I don't think back when I was in that the United States would have just kept quiet or just maybe bombed a couple of ammo depots. We would have actually gone in and taken care of business a little bit more. And of course, nobody wants that. But if a big nation or a nation like Iran is already starting things like this and pushing for things like this, it's, I mean, for us to get involved fully, it's really no question in my
sure,
particular
but,
opinion.
But let's just look at it from this perspective. I mean, the United States was in both Iraq and Afghanistan for close to 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did we accomplish there?
No. I totally get that. I understand that. And I know we just talked about the tit for tat where
you raise an important point, but you know, ultimately, I mean, what did the United States accomplish for Afghanistan? What did the United States accomplish in Iraq? Right?
Well, if you ask anybody, it would be all about oil, obviously, right? So we all know that. Right? So So that's a separate topic in, you
that's
know,
another in, podcast.
That's another podcast.
Sure.
Yeah.
But to your point, Carlos, I mean, you're right. Like, what did we accomplish? And there are some people who even say that with the actions that the Israeli military are taking right now and looking for Hamas, that potentially all that may happen is that because it's my understanding Hamas is kind of like, it's organized in like different wings, like a military wing, a political wing, that potentially all that's going to happen is that the movement will go underground. It's not going to completely disappear. Yeah. And to your point, it's going to be like, what do we really accomplish?
They will morph into something else. Yes. If the situation doesn't change.
Yes. Yes.
They will morph. You know, keep in mind, Israel, you know, occupied southern Lebanon for, I don't know, close to 20 years. Did they eliminate Hezbollah?
Right.
No. Yeah, it's.
Well, I think this is crazy. Definitely, as we mentioned before, this is such a complex topic. I'm actually really proud that we've spent an hour and a half, three Latinos talking about this, and I think we've covered so much ground. I know, Carlos, you are, again,
phenomenal, man.
You have educated us and given us so much to think about, and I hope that our listeners also benefit from this and take the time to listen to this and really think about what's going on in the world before you react and kind of speak out without having the education or the knowledge behind your words. Thank you so much. I mean, we're really honored. This is our first podcast that we're launching the Modern Latino with, and I'm very proud that we were able to do a show that wasn't about la comida or música or the stuff that you hear all the time, right? Like
the cowbell, right?
There's nothing wrong with la música. Let me just tell you.
There's nothing wrong with it, but we are complex, right? Like you, like we have opinions, and we can talk about all different kinds of subjects. And you know, like it's one of those things. I always tell, we talk about Hispanic Heritage Month, and I'm like, why do we have a month? And then it's half of 2 months. Like we can cover all kinds of subjects at any time, and really do a good job. And I feel absolutely. Like you were so phenomenal, as Jim mentioned.
Let me likewise, number one, you know, I consider it a pleasure and a privilege to be on your podcast. I applaud both of you for doing this program. Again, you know, you mentioned three Latinos tackling, you know, a highly complex geopolitical issue with incredible implications for the entire world. We need to make our voices heard in this country.
Absolutely.
You know, and your program is a really great a step in that direction. You know, and you mentioned that earlier you asked if I might recommend some books.
Yes, please.
And I mentioned to Ivan, I said, well, you know, the books that I'll give you will cover a lot of ground. They are books that I've read personally. Mark Tesler's The Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, you know, very, very wide ranging. Then you have The Question of Palestine by Edward Said. You know, on the other side, there's a book by Alan Dershowitz called The Case for Israel. You know, I believe there was one more book whose name I can't remember right now. Tom Friedman's From Beirut to Jerusalem.
Yes.
You know, another excellent book. There's a lot of things that are really condensed and broken down for you. And all of those books, you know, even though most of them were published in the last, you know, 10, 20 years, even more, they're still highly relevant today. And I want to just, you know, end my comments by saying that, you know, we are history, the three of us. We live in history. We live in the wake of history. And we can impact history in this country positively doing what you're doing here.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
That's my hope.
Thank you so much for those book recommendations. Fans of the show, please make sure you take the time out to rent them at the library or pick them up. And Carlos, we would love to have you. So we like to have a lot of fun. We'd love to have you maybe join us on another episode. I know you're in a salsa band, right? You play cowbell.
I play cowbell and I sing a little bit.
Oh,
all right.
You know, they call me El Cantante. So,
we're definitely going to have you come back and join us for another fun show.
Absolutely.
We're going to be taking our show on the road as well. So maybe we could even do something in person. We've got a lot lined up for this, for our kickoff season of the podcast, the Modern Latino Podcast. So we would love to have you join us again.
Well, let me know. I'll bring out my campana, you know, and,
perfect.
You know, I can make it happen. You know, my one of my taglines is paz y salsa.
Oh, paz y salsa. Nice. I like that.
All right.
Pues so, Carlos, muchas gracias.
Por estar con nosotros. As we say, you know, muchas gracias. Que Dios los bendiga.
Sí, señor.
Ha sido un privilegio y un placer.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Carlos. All right.
Have a good night.
Take care.
Gracias, Carlos.
Bye-bye.